Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 9th of July, these are our main stories. Oxfam warns hunger could be a bigger killer than the coronavirus. China says relations with the United States are facing their most serious challenge since the 1970s. And the mayor of the South Korean capital, Seoul, has gone missing. Also in this podcast...
It's a phenomenon that has occurred throughout history. So during the Great Depression, in between the two world wars, music that was popular became more positive. It happened during the financial crash.
It seems the music we're dancing to is getting faster and happier. There are concerns that the long-term effects of the coronavirus have not yet been felt, and the international aid agency Oxfam has warned that the disruption of harvests and food supplies in some of the world's poorest countries during the pandemic means more people could die of malnutrition than from the disease itself. Oxfam's chief executive, Danny Seeskandarajan, told us more.
We're really worried about the health impact of coronavirus, but it's also becoming increasingly clear that this is a hunger virus. Oxfam estimates that 122 million more people will be pushed into extreme hunger this year because of the pandemic's economic fallout, you know, disruption to food production and supplies, declining aid, declining remittances, unemployment. And that equates to 12,000 people dying a day by the end of the year, which is actually more than the global peak of coronavirus health-related deaths that we saw in April.
And which parts of the world are suffering the most badly?
We're particularly worried about countries like Yemen or Syria, where war and devastation have already disrupted societies, but also places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Sudan, South Sudan, where there are already extreme levels of poverty and hunger, and where coronavirus is effectively a crisis on top of many other existing crises.
And you have flagged up this concern. What would you like the international community to do about it?
The simplest thing to do is to fund the emergency appeal that United Nations has launched already to address hunger. And unfortunately, only a quarter of that appeal has been funded by governments around the world. Another simple thing governments can do is champion debt relief. Many of the poorest countries in the world are struggling to make their debt repayments. And it was within the gift of major Western countries to issue a moratorium on some of that debt relief, which would allow poorer countries to be able to fund the sort of activities they need to alleviate poverty and suffering in their countries.
That was Danny Seeskandarajan of Oxfam. Tensions are continuing to rise between the United States and China. In a speech posted online, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi accused the US of trying to turn China into an enemy. It comes after the director of the FBI said acts of espionage and theft by the Chinese government pose the greatest long-term threat to the future of the US. Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell was listening to Mr. Wang's speech.
China's foreign minister wasn't pulling his punches. He said current US policy towards China is based on strategic misjudgments, which lack a factual basis and is full of emotional outbursts and McCarthyist prejudice. However, in a speech posted on the Foreign Ministry's website, Wang Yi also said that relations between Washington and Beijing could be repaired. Though they were currently in their most challenging state since the resumption of diplomatic relations in 1979, he said the two sides should explore ways to peacefully coexist and release more positive energy.
That was Stephen McDonnell. Meanwhile, China has also issued a warning to Australia after Canberra announced plans to offer safe haven to thousands of people from Hong Kong following Beijing's imposition of a controversial national security law in the territory. Speaking at a news briefing in Beijing, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian warned his country might retaliate.
The comments and measures from the Australian side constitute grave violations of international law and basic norms of international relations and gross interference in China's domestic affairs. It will not work on China. We condemn that and reserve the right to take further actions in response. All consequences shall be borne by the Australian side.
Our Sydney correspondent Phil Mercer has been following the story.
Essentially, what the Australian government is offering is to extend the visas of Hong Kong workers and students in this country by 5 years. This will give them a pathway to permanent residency. And the Australian officials are saying that this could accommodate up to 10,000 people. So quite a large cohort of people will be offered a safe haven visa because of very strident comments made by the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. He says that these new national security laws in Hong Kong brought in by the Chinese undermined, in Australia's opinion, Hong Kong's own basic law and the territory's current level of autonomy.
And Australia is also trying to entice businesses from Hong Kong, isn't it?
Yes, it wants to give incentives to businesses currently with bases in Hong Kong to relocate to Australia. Now, this has a political and both an economic edge to it as well. It's all part of Australia's political response to what's happening in Hong Kong. And also there's a bit of economic self-interest in there as well. COVID-19 has hammered the Australian economy as it has in other parts of the world. Australia is facing its first recession since the early 1990s. And there is a hope that perhaps out of the tumult in Hong Kong could come a bit of economic salvation for Australia. Many Hong Kong people did move in the past to Australia, setting up very successful businesses or bringing those businesses with them. And there is an expectation, perhaps, that Australia is hoping that the same might happen this time around.
You mentioned that there is a package of measures relating to Hong Kong. What other steps is Australia taking?
Australia is also suspending its extradition treaty with Hong Kong. And all of this, as you'd imagine, has absolutely infuriated China. So diplomatic tensions between Australia and China have been festering in recent times. And this is yet another uncomfortable episode in those diplomatic ties.
That was Phil Mercer in Sydney. The mayor of the South Korean capital Seoul, Park Won-soon, has been reported as missing and a search operation is underway. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow has the details.
The mayor was reported missing by his daughter on Thursday evening. She said her father had left home 4 or 5 hours earlier with words that hinted not all was well. His mobile phone was switched off. Officials are reported to have said the mayor didn't turn up for work on Thursday because of health issues. The police have deployed officers, drones and tracker dogs to search for the missing 64-year-old. The former activist and human rights lawyer was in his third term as mayor of Seoul. Some in South Korea saw him as a possible future presidential candidate.
That was Michael Bristow. Scientists say they have new evidence of an epic Pacific voyage between the Americas and eastern Polynesia about 800 years ago, making it one of the longest seaborne migrations in history. Researchers at Stanford University found that Polynesians and the indigenous population in South America first made contact in about the year 1200, but they don't know which side made the journey across the ocean, as the lead author of the study, Alexander Ioannidis, told the BBC's James Copnell.
What we're looking at here is either a journey of the Polynesian navigators who were exploring the most remote Polynesian islands at that time and discovering them. And it's possible that in that process, they discovered not an island, but a continent. Having arrived in South America, there was some mixture between the Native Americans and the Polynesians. And then some of them returned and brought that back. The other possibility is that Native Americans actually drifted. And if they had drifted out into the Pacific, the currents would have taken them into the Marquesas and the Tuamotus.
So that's fascinating. You're not quite sure in which direction the journey went. I mean, what's your best guess?
Well, I would say that because the timing is exactly at the period when the Polynesians were embarking on their longest voyages of discovery, and soon after they would discover Easter Island, which is extremely remote, and also later settling New Zealand and Hawaii, that they had no idea that there was going to be a continent eventually and they were going to run out of islands. So I think they probably did find a continent. They would sail upwind when they were trying to discover new islands. This is the anthropologist's beliefs anyway, because if they didn't find an island, that way they could return home swiftly. I mean, they're sailing across 1,000 kilometers of open ocean here. And so upwind sailing from the Tuamotus and Marquesas actually takes you to the coast of Ecuador and Colombia. And that's exactly where we find the Native American ancestry came from in the Polynesians.
And this has been at least a theory for some time now. why exactly? What sort of similarities, perhaps, can one find in the two cultures that led people to believe that this is something that did happen all that time ago?
People have long known that there were sweet potatoes, actually, in Polynesia. The sweet potato is a New World crop. It was domesticated in Central America and South America. The sweet potato was out there in the Polynesian Islands before the Europeans ever came. And so it's been a question, how did that happen? And the other interesting fact is the word used in the Polynesian Islands, which is variants of the word kumara, is related to the word used in northwestern South America by the Native Americans. And so that was also an interesting observation, but it was suggestive, but not proof of contact. And we have found genetic proof of contact, and we find it to have occurred in northwestern South America. So that sort of makes sense.
Alexander Ioannidis talking to James Copnell. Still to come in this podcast.
95 is acceptable saturation, isn't it?
No, parents have saw 91% with this.
Yeah, so I think...
We hear from the doctors fighting the coronavirus in Pakistan from thousands of miles away. 5 years ago, the German car manufacturer Volkswagen admitted to using illegal software to cheat US diesel engine tests in a scandal which became known as Dieselgate. Europe's highest court has now ruled that drivers who bought cars fitted with such devices can sue Volkswagen wherever they bought their vehicle, not just in Germany. So how significant is this? Here's our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Well, it's significant, Jackie, in that it means that a number of cases which have in fact already been launched are representing tens of thousands of consumers across Europe who bought Volkswagen cars that were equipped with defeat devices can continue to sue the company in their home countries. This was kind of a delaying tactic by Volkswagen, or an attempt to fight off some of these national cases by suggesting that only courts in Germany should have jurisdiction. And what we had here with the European Court was a case referred from Austria, where one of many cases is going ahead, and the Court of Justice had been asked to rule on whether or not national courts had the jurisdiction to hear cases like this. It's ruled that they do, and it's ruled that consumers, when they bought cars equipped with defeat devices, at that point were effectively buying defective products, and that therefore it's worth considering in the national courts whether or not they should be compensated for buying those vehicles.
And just how much damage economically could this potentially inflict on Volkswagen?
Well, Volkswagen has already seen the vast majority of economic damage for the so-called Dieselgate affair. It's already paid out more than $30 billion in fines and settlements and buying back cars. But most of that money has been paid out in the United States. There was a significant settlement in Germany as well, which costed about €1 billion. But the ongoing legal residue of this is now in Europe, and it's European consumers who have not been compensated in the way that their American peers have, trying to get some kind of payment from Volkswagen. And these cases can now go ahead, which means the likelihood is greater than it was that Volkswagen may at some point have to pay out if those courts decide that Volkswagen was guilty of wrongdoing and that consumers have suffered as a result.
That was Theo Leggett. Back to coronavirus now, and the number of cases in the Japanese capital has reached a record high. It comes as the country is preparing to further relax restrictions on large-scale events. Our correspondent Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports from Tokyo.
For the last week, Tokyo has seen new COVID infections running at about 100 a day. But today, that figure jumped to 224. It's the highest single-day figure the Japanese capital has seen so far. The next highest was 206, all the way back at the beginning of April. Officials point out that this new higher figure is partly the result of dramatically increased testing. But there is no doubt, since the state of emergency was lifted here a little over a month ago, new infection clusters have been breaking out with increased regularity. Many appear to be concentrated in Tokyo's late-night entertainment districts. Several clusters have been traced to so-called host and hostess bars. Today's leap in infections will put more pressure on the government, just as it was about to reopen large public sporting events this weekend. From Friday night, up to 5,000 people at a time will be allowed to enter stadiums to watch professional football matches and baseball games.
That was Rupert Wingfield-Hayes in Tokyo. Pakistan's healthcare system is feeling the brunt of the coronavirus crisis and is struggling to cope. There have been almost 250,000 confirmed cases in the country and close to 5,000 deaths, although the real figures could be higher. Now, a group of British Pakistani doctors who fought the virus in the UK are using what they've learnt and new technology to help their counterparts in Pakistan. Our South Asia correspondent Sukanda Kamani spoke to some of the medical workers at the front line of the pandemic.
95 is acceptable saturation, isn't it?
From his home just outside London, Dr. Tahir Akhtar is helping treat a coronavirus patient in Lahore.
At this point, I think
via video link, a doctor there shows him around the intensive care ward at Jinnah Hospital and talks through the cases.
14 days of fever and dry
cough. Dr. Tahir helped lead the COVID-19 response where he lives, and now he hopes his experience here can help the country of his birth.
Because of our relationships, both in medicine and otherwise in Pakistan, it was very important for us to help our colleagues and to help the people of Pakistan.
The project has been created by another UK-based doctor, Sohail Chugtai. He's also created a number of other telemedicine portals, including one in which doctors from here, alongside those in Pakistan, offer free online consultations to coronavirus patients.
In Pakistan, COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire, and we haven't got resources there to really plug the gaps of service. So any skill, any special skill from UK would be warmly welcome in Pakistan.
Over the past month, under-resourced hospitals in Pakistan have come under intense pressure, and it seemed they wouldn't be able to cope when lockdown restrictions were lifted towards the end of May. But in the past 2 weeks, in some places, they've noticed a major decrease in admissions.
4 weeks ago, we didn't have enough oxygen, and two or three patients were sharing through the same oxygen port. And now, some wards are completely empty.
Dr. Amara Khalid works at Mayo Hospital in Lahore. She and her colleagues are trying to work out whether a new targeted lockdown by the government is working, or if residents are simply not going to hospital because of the spread of conspiracy theories that doctors are killing off patients.
Even the patients who were coming, they were scared and they would want to go home, and, you know, they were reluctant to get admission in the hospital. So we definitely thought that it's just because of the fear that people have. But the cases have definitely declined as well. Because whenever somebody gets very critical, then they have to bring their patient to the hospital, right?
Prime Minister Imran Khan's government says its measures are working. He has repeatedly opposed a full lockdown, warning the country's poorest will be too badly affected. Officials insist the fatality rate is much lower than in the West. According to official statistics, that's right. But at graveyards in the country's two largest cities, we've obtained data suggesting there's been a significant rise in burials this June compared to last year that can't be accounted for by recorded coronavirus deaths alone. The increase could be the result of undetected cases or people dying from other diseases they can't get treatment for. But with testing rates low and some unwilling or unable to seek medical treatment, it's perhaps only in these graveyards the true impact of the pandemic can be measured.
Sukanda Kamani reporting. Now, sometimes the work of conservationists must seem like an uphill struggle against global warming and environmental degradation, but occasionally there is some good news. Experts have released the first known pictures of the world's rarest gorillas with a group of babies in Nigeria's Mbeya Mountains on the border with Cameroon. It's proof that the Cross River gorillas, once feared to be extinct, are reproducing amid protection measures. My colleague Alan Kasuja spoke to Ina Oyom Imong, who works for a conservation organisation in Nigeria.
The Wildlife Conservation Society has for many years now been working with the government of Nigeria and with the government of Cross River State, where these gorillas occur in Nigeria, to improve protected area management. This is key to the survival of these animals, improving effectiveness of law enforcement, bringing attention to these very endangered animals.
You say endangered, but they're extremely, extremely rare, are they not? I have looked for a photograph of them and I can't seem to find one.
Exactly, that is the point. They are so rare to see. We rarely see these animals. To give you an idea, I've been studying and I'm working to conserve these gorillas for close to 20 years now, and I have only managed to see them in the wild myself twice. Once clearly, the second time not so clearly. There are people who have worked in the landscape where these animals live for over 10 years and never managed to find them. Therefore, these images that we got recently are extremely exciting, as you can understand.
The thought of that. You work 10 years working on a gorilla, and you've never set your eyes on it. That's crazy. What are you doing?
Exactly. So the point is this: there are so few of them left, only about 100 left in Nigeria. And well, luckily for them, they still have substantial area of forest left where they can expand to.
Okay.
Therefore, because they roam over such a large area, it's difficult to actually track them and see them.
Okay.
You are extremely lucky when you see them.
So how do you know there are 100 if you can't even see them?
We haven't been able to count them like some other animals are counted. We study them using indirect signs that they leave behind. For example, the nest where they sleep. So each gorilla constructs a nest from plants where it sleeps each night. So by counting those and following other tracks, we managed to get some estimate of the animals.
Ina Oyom Imong speaking to Alan Kasuja about the rising numbers of endangered gorillas. And on that note, BBC research has found that pop music is getting happier and faster. Have a listen. The research looked at the biggest hits on the UK charts streamed on Spotify over the last decade and found that recent songs have faster tempos and scored higher on the happiness scale. Yes, really. Our music reporter, Mark Savage, told us more.
The interesting thing is that music is suddenly getting faster after a long period where hip-hop was the dominant genre and started to bleed into pop music. Tempos were getting slower. In America, they got as low as 90 beats per minute, which is, you know, that's some people's resting heart rate. But in the last 6 to 12 months, the tempo was shot up to 122, which is more like a light jog. And it kind of suggests that people are listening to more upbeat music during the lockdown, that they're looking for something that provides a bit of escapism and fantasy. And it's interesting, it's a phenomenon that has occurred throughout history. So during the Great Depression, in between the two world wars, music that was popular became more positive. It happened during the financial crash. The last big peak in the speed of music was around 2009, when it was just slightly higher than it is now, at 124 beats per minute. So it seems like people are using the music as a way of just distracting themselves from the general awfulness of everything else.
How do you measure a happiness rate?
So this is the thing. Spotify very helpfully does this for us. Every track in their database, and that's more than 50 million songs, is rated and ranked according to a number of different metrics. So they know the tempo, they know what key it's in, whether it's major or minor. And one of the other measurements they have is called valence. And that kind of synthesizes lots of different things, how lively the music is, whether it's acoustic or more electronic, and the lyrics that it has. And that all compiles into this measurement, like I say, called valence, and that is essentially a measure of happiness. As I looked through all of the songs that we studied for this survey, and there were about 400 of them in total, the one that came out with the highest happiness rating was Happy, and Pharrell Williams' Happy has a happiness score of 97%.
And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, or you want to share your happy song, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.